Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the show that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. We've got a great show for you today as we continue our exploration of the climate emergency and how exactly designers should be responding. I've asked an old friend to join us on the show. Marianne Lazarus is an American architect and advocate and currently a consultant at the Cameron McAllister Group. She's a longtime leader in the field of sustainable design. She was the founder of the Sustainable Design Initiative at Helmuth, Abada, and Casaubon. And she did so at a time when it was thought that corporate architecture and ecological responsibility would be incompatible. She's also worked extensively with the American Institute of Architects and the U.S. Green Building Council on establishing guidelines and protocols for sustainable practice. She designs the systems that allow us all to design green. As you'll hear shortly, Marianne was formative in my own career. About 10 years before I actually met her, I got my hands on her book, and it was so early in my practice that it really shaped the way that I thought about design, and it has ever since. Marianne and I had a provocative chat talking about all the ways in which designers can become advocates for a better world. As you listen, see if you can pick up on an emerging theme. As I've been discussing with various design leaders on this segment, they all seem to zero in on a particular approach, namely that designers can get off their butts, start designing codes, policies, systems, etc. If those particular barriers aren't evolving fast enough for what we need to do, then I guess we got to design them too. Anyhow, have a listen to the interview and let me know what you think. And now, here's Marianne Lazarus. Marianne, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm great.
Usually I let my guests start with a story, but I'd like to start with one of my own. It was 20 years ago. I was a young newbie architect working at a firm, wet behind the ears, and someone brought in this book, this very authoritarian-looking book that was HOK's Guide to Sustainable Design. And, I was fascinated. I was drawn in because it had this gravitas to it. And it was my personal introduction to sustainable design. And you and I would not meet for another 10 years, I think, after that. And then when we did, I was like, oh, right, Marianne Lazarus. And it was a real fanboy moment for me. So thank you for that. But I was wondering if we could dial it back about 20 years or maybe longer, and you could tell our audience a little bit about your introduction to sustainable design and,
sure,
you know, how you came to enter that field and when you figured out that it was going to be your mission or one of them in architecture.
Okay. Well, I'll try not to bow back too far, but I'm going to start actually a long time ago because I became interested in architecture and actually went to architecture school in the late 70s, which was, for those who were still around then, right after the oil embargo. And interestingly, when I went to graduate school, which was at Washington University in St. Louis, where I still live and where you also went, Eric.
True.
It was sort of this kind of interesting moment in time where the focus on what they called environmental responsible design was a primary area of interest for some of the faculty. And I happened to land there in the 1976 when I showed up, which was a couple years after I graduated from college. So I was one of those people who didn't do undergraduate architecture. I went afterwards. And one of the first studios I took was with a young faculty member who had recently graduated from Yale named George Z. Charlie Brown. And for those who knew Charlie, he moved on to the University of Oregon and has had generations of students who have really become deeply entrenched in the sustainability movement for decades now. So I would consider myself one of Charlie's first, you know, I'm like first generation, but there are many.
First generation Charlie.
First generation Charlie. So I actually got exposed to this concept of the impact of the environment, of built environment on the environment, if you will, and sort of the traditional kind of environmental side of sustainability way back then, as did many others who were part of that world. We also had a deep look at social equity issues. Mike Piatuck was one of our instructors at that point, who went on to become very well known in affordable housing and other areas around equity. So it was just this really interesting time at WashU then. And so I graduated, and I was already sort of set up to be mission-driven, just based on my background, coming from an academic community where, you know, what you did mattered. It wasn't about money, a profit, or anything. It was really about the difference you could make. That was certainly value instilled in me by my parents from, you know, day one. So I was always like looking for a purpose beyond, you know, design as an end unto itself. So it was sort of a natural fit for me. And anyway, I joined HOK, which, you know, big, large firm in St. Louis, actually the second job out of graduate school. And, you know, the first decade of that was fairly traditional architecture, 80s. Stuff, postmodernism, and some of the, you know, awful things that were going on then.
But, they made sense at the time.
It probably did. But I was just, you know, becoming accredited, I mean, registered and having my first children and doing all these very busy stuff. And then, you know, amazingly, HOK took on the kind of leadership as a large firm around sustainability in the early 90s. And that really was due to Guy Obata, the O of HOK, and his own value set. It was based on the influence of a very important figure in St. Louis, actually global, Peter Raven, who was the director of the Missouri Botanical Garden, which is one of the top three botanical gardens in the world, influencing HOK. But anyway, the board agreed in early 90s that environmental stewardship was one of the core values of HOK. And they kind of unleashed this undercurrent of people who were all interested in this topic to, you know, spend some time thinking about what that meant for design. It was not, you know, really funded as much as sort of, yes, we want to know what this really means. And it is important to us. It's a core value to us as a large firm, you know, having impact globally. We recognize we have a responsibility. So I was one of those, you know, early Green Team members. There were others much more prominent than I. Sandy Medler is one that people probably know at Methuen in San Francisco, Bill O'Dell, you know, and others. And some of the earliest work that was done was through those design leaders and, you know, across the country that became sort of the basis for our reputation, HOK's reputation as a sustainability leader. At the same time, this little green team started developing checklists, internal checklists, for us to use on our projects. And at some point, I'm told, the story goes, that Sandy Medler was at a conference, one of the early sustainability conferences, and she had a mimeograph copy, or maybe Xerox back then, of this checklist, which was by, you know, energy, water, materials, site, etc. And because we were early into the development of LEED, so it was sort of organized around LEED categories, and someone said, oh, can I get a copy of that? And she said, sure, you know, send me $10 and I'll Xerox it and put it in the mail. And then she got all this many people asking for a copy of HOK's checklist. And we were always about sharing, never worried about proprietary knowledge. And at some point, this publisher got a hold of the fact that there was this checklist out there that people were getting interested in. That was Wiley. And they came to HOK and said, would you guys be willing to write a book?
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's the origin of the first guidebook. And then we did a second guidebook that sort of took it to the next level that I was co-author on. And in each of those guidebooks, we did checklists. And it was sort of before Wiki. It was sort of very focused on applicable, practical knowledge. You know, it wasn't esoteric, academic. It was like, here's how you do it. Here's examples of how you do it. Here's a one-pager on, you know, what green roofs are. Here's a one-pager on, you know, embodied carbon. We talked about embodied carbon back then, you know. Here's some spec language. I mean, it was as laying it out there as much as we could, never expecting it to be something that would be used as a textbook, but it did end up becoming a textbook in architecture programs. So that was sort of the background on that. And I became more and more involved and enmeshed in that process until at some point in the early 2000s, I asked and became the first sustainable design firm-wide sustainable design director.
So let's talk about what's changed as you were describing the heady times. I remember them clearly. And, you know, I remember that book and the attitude towards sustainability being simultaneously very fresh and very sort of reassuring. Like, you know, it had already been thought out by yourself and the other authors of that book. What has changed? I mean, obviously a lot. We started this segment because there began to be a lot of buzz around the climate emergency. And I guess that's what we're talking about now as opposed to climate change or global warming. Is it just terms changing? I mean, what has changed in terms of the way we approach sustainability?
Well, I think a lot has changed in terms of how we approach sustainability. And, you know, the climate emergency, you know, is its urgency, It's not sort of happening or future. I wake up in a sweat about this stuff all the time. I mean, we are really at a precipice of action, and I don't believe our profession is taking it nearly seriously enough. There's a lot of really great movement recently, and we can go into that in the architectural world and outside the architectural world, but it's just doesn't meet the pace that needs to happen. And that wasn't really what we were thinking about, you know, 25 years ago. We were thinking about environmental responsibility, really thinking about sustainability and sustain. You know, how do we maintain? And at the moment, we can't maintain. We need to change.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And I mean, what's the radical vision? I mean, give me your top three or your top five things that designers just need to do differently starting this morning to address this crisis.
One of the things that I'm completely fixated on for architects is this concept of climate stationarity. I love that word. And I love words. I have some other words I can share with you, too. That basically is the tendency for architects or for anybody in the thinking about design to use past data, to use historical climate data. And we can't do that anymore. It is not okay to design anything that's going to be around for 10 years or more based on historical data. And our system is set up to look at historical data. And that's the way we've always been trained to do. That's how the data is available. When we look at psychometric charts, that's based on historical data. And that needs to change. It needs to change fast. And there are efforts underway. I mean, ASHRAE is working on that. There are tools and resources out there. But typically, we don't do that. And it's just, irresponsible, in my opinion, because we are not designing for, future comfort or health or wellness if we aren't taking into account changes in precipitation and temperature and humidity and things like health risks and all those things that are happening. And so that's one. I would say we have to start building in the opportunity and the need to look at future climate projections at a very location-based when we're designing. So that's one. The other one is to recognize not just the role of mitigation. I mean, that's all. We've been talking about that a long time. But this whole kind of decarbonization effort. And that's something that AIA is really focused on as an action item. We're still figuring out what that really means. But it means not just reducing the emissions of our impacts. And there's lots of ways we can do that. Passive design being certainly one of them. But it also means thinking about the embodied carbon of our products, which is something that's just kind of getting underway, but we have to take very seriously. Because, according to Ed Masri and others, that's the more immediate impact is in our selection of materials. So that's this whole decarbonization movement. If you look at some of the information that came out of the climate summit in San Francisco a year ago, they looked at the building sector and what needs to happen in the building sector to meet Paris Agreement. It's really about decarbonization. I like that term. That's another term I like. It's kind of fun. So decarbonization, Matt, interestingly, it's sort of a corollary of that is something that I just was reading this morning that I know not enough about, but I think it's something architects need to be really aware of, and that is about how we can adapt to the grid changes over time.
You're listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Marianne Lazarus and the catchy story about how all this sustainable expertise went viral and became one of the mainstays on my bookshelf. But we're going to take a quick break. While we're breaking, check us out on social media, where you can find out more about Marianne and our other work. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IM. When we get back, we're going to be talking more about the future and how designers can get involved beyond the design to shape the built environment in so many necessary ways. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We've been speaking with Marianne Lazarus of the Cameron McAllister Group about the history of green design and our own early trajectories therein. Coming up, we're going to be talking about changing building codes and how designers can use their cool points to make change. Let's rejoin the conversation. Marianne, when we left off, you were speaking about grid change. I'm not totally sure I know what that is, but you were talking about how architects will adapt to that. Can we drill down on that? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I wish I knew more, so I would ask you to interview Mark Frankel at NBI. But the point of that is, as we one of the reasons why we want to switch to electric, all electric, it's like the 1950s when I grew up, it's all electric homes, and my mother hated that. Now all electric means something different because the renewable energy can much more directly feed into all electric, right? And then we have all kinds of advantages of battery backups and recharging our electric cars and everything. So if we can shift existing buildings and all new construction to all electric, that will help us as we transition to a much higher percentage of renewable energy on the grid. But there is this variability in renewable energy sources, daytime solar, wind comes and goes, depends upon where you are, very dependent on where you are. And this profile of how the renewable energy flows is specific to location. California is different than, Texas is different than Hawaii, et cetera. In order to reduce the demand for dirty energy, which of course is filling in the holes when the renewable energy can't meet it, and that dirty energy tends to be the stuff we really don't want to use, that we need to figure out a way to flatten the curve. So that kind of understanding the energy, that not just looking at annual energy use and how do we get to zero or whatever it might be, but looking at daily diurnal changes and how do we adjust our buildings to be able to reflect and quickly adapt to opportunities that the grid are offering or not offering will not only save us money, but it also will help in this long-term goal of, really driving down carbon emissions. So that's a level that I think we don't, architects aren't aware of. This was an article I read today in Building Green, but it certainly sounds like the next level is an infrastructure issue that we in the building environment, have some impacts on as we need to really plan forward for that. So that'd be a corollary of the decarbonization goal.
So I want to ask a couple of related questions in sequence, but you're suggesting a sort of lack of knowledge or a lack of commitment or both? I mean, when we say like, okay, architects need to be a lot better about this, is it a knowledge gap or is it a commitment gap or both?
I think it's both. And I speak with my own, blinders on, obviously. I've come from a world where I was part of a large firm with a very deep commitment to sustainability. I worked with AIA for several years on their strategy around sustainability, and both as a volunteer and a consultant. And, so I sort of understand different perspectives from an architecture world. And, as you know, Eric, because that's how we met, I've been focused on resilience now for, over 10 years. And what I'm finding is, that the interest in these topics from, early day sustainability, old time sustainability to resilience is very different based on location, based on client type, based on the makeup of a firm and their value set. And there are lots of firms that, in my opinion, are still stuck in 1990s that are saying, well, I'm not going to do this unless the client tells me to. Gee, Marianne, I'd be really interested in doing that. I'm really interested in this topic, but, my clients aren't. And that seems to be a pretty common response, unfortunately. And then there are others who are way ahead of the game and are really doing exciting things and trying new ideas and pushing it and bringing things to their clients and explaining to the clients the market advantage they have or the risk management issues they're addressing and, getting things done. So this latest issue, that one I was just talking about, that I just read about this morning, which has to do with understanding the grid and how do we actually build for a grid that is more adaptable, flexible, that I think is lack of knowledge. It's just coming out. Understanding the carbon, embodying carbon of our materials is really just coming out. New products are being developed that address those, but are not being, not in the mainstream selection yet in some regards. So it really depends, but I do think a lot of it has to do with our own recalcitrance. I just think even unwillingness to change. It seems to be hard to do.
Yeah, harder than it should be, given the sort of crisis at the door. I wanted to reflect on something you said, Marianne. This hypothetical designer that comes to you and says, hey, Marianne, I'm really interested in this. If my client cares about it. I'll ask what I've asked of every guest on this segment, basically, is you know, what agency do you lie at the feet of designers? Because I've heard that plenty of times as well. You know, the, hey, I really care about the environment. I want to design in ways that are, you know, more climate responsive, more climate responsible. It's just that the market doesn't want it. Do we have to start talking about ways to evolve the actual structure of the profession so that it, for lack of a better term, stands up to the market and is actually ahead of the inclinations of the market in terms of being responsible towards the environment? And if so, what does that look like?
Well, I think there are several strategies to address this. There are ways at a project level, at a client level, to, you know, make a case. I don't think saying, you know, a client isn't interested works. And that comes from years at HOK, where we would hear that and we'd say, well, you know, you want to make people in your building healthier, you know, do you want to save money on your energy bills, you know, water bills? Hey, let me give you some ideas. So, you know, you don't just say, okay, well, I'm going to do whatever basic design, you know, standard design is. We'd come back with, you know, something that, you know, that's just standard practice, is to find things that align with their own values, or find the person within the place that you're working with who does resonate and has some influence, and keep on working at it. You don't just give up. So I think there is a role that we can play if really committed. And I do think architects have an important responsibility here. We, you know, the AIA last year adopted the code of ethics for obligations to the environment that require, I'm going to read this to you. If you want to be a member in good standing at AIA, that is to say, maintain your AI membership, you have to consider with their clients the environmental effects of their project decisions. That's a rule. That's sort of like the, you know, Ten Commandments of AIA, the Code of Ethics. And we are obligated to talk about environmental effects on our project decisions with our clients. And then it gets into more specifics about energy and water and materials selection and ecosystem impacts and climate change. So, you know, there is an understanding, at least AIA, much to their credit, that this is something that we are doing as responsible built environment professionals. The other piece of this that I'm more in kind of enamored of lately, if you will, is the role of everybody, citizens and architects as citizens, and architects as influential citizens in some regards. I think we do have sort of, people think we're cool.
Speak for yourself.
Well, I mean, not me particularly, but you know, when you say I'm an architect, they go, "Oh, cool," and I'm like, "Not really." And when, you know, my brothers, who are both really phenomenal lawyers, environmental lawyers, say they're lawyers, they don't get, "Oh, cool," right?
Okay, all right, I'll give you that one.
But anyway, to affect the mainstream, you know, to really think about how we can influence the things that we are responding to, you know, how can we change the market conditions? So that instead of it being an uphill battle, it's like, let's just go with it. Let's make it, you know, enhance it. How can we change regulations? This is why the things like Ed Mazzuri is doing with the Zero Code is so important. How do we change code?
Yeah.
You know, that's going to get us along. You know, people in California, you in California have Title 24 with some pretty, you know, ambitious goals for new construction. I'm in Missouri where there's no statewide building code. You know, show me state. We don't want anyone to tell us what to do. So it's crazy, right? But, you know, I'm really starting to think that as much as we do want to work at a project level, and we should, and that's where our sweet spot is, if you will, because that's what we do on a daily basis, we need to be out there advocating for other kinds of changes. The way funding happens, you know, I discovered recently that in Connecticut, there's a thing, I've forgotten the name, it's a Q something, is a method by which affordable housing dollars are being allocated. There's a point system, and they've changed it so that, you know, some sustainability indicators get more points. You know, if you are net zero or close to net zero, you get more points. And all of a sudden, guess what? Affordable housing is becoming more, you know, sustainable because of the point system.
Funny how that works. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's those kinds of triggers, the way that, you know, can we get better insurance rates? Because buildings are being designed to be resilient, right? You'd hope so. And that drives the developer market. So I'm starting to think we need, you know, we do have an obligation, and we do have there are ways to talk to clients that are not necessarily already lined up, but we also have a way to influence at our zoning boards as, you know, elected officials, working with our elected officials at every level, and, you know, things like these regulatory issues to actually see, you know, change the ground rules. That's what I'm interested in.
Marianne, I think that's so important for our audience to hear, and a damn near poetic place to end in terms of thinking about the designer, not just a designer of a building or a landscape, but a world, or a designer of a new set of ground rules, as you put it. You know, I always try and tell my students that the design skills that they're being taught don't need to restrict themselves to a particular medium. You know, you can design policy, you can design community, you can design all sorts of things. It's a matter of where your commitment and your interest and your passion lies.
Exactly. You can't say it better than that. I hope your students are taking that to heart as well, because I'm counting on them.
I will certainly force this podcast upon them. So, Marianne, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining
us. You're welcome, Eric. Good talking with you.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank my guest of the week, Marianne Lazarus of the Cameron McAllister Group, for bringing us the wisdom from her long career of advocating green. I hope our audience takes in Marianne's exhortation for advocacy. There's much more to our work than just designing green. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure I know what that means anymore, but I do know that designers are often at their best when they turn their design talents in unexpected directions. So, design a future for yourself and the rest of us, and don't let anyone get in your way. To learn more about Marianne and her work, please visit our website at currystonefoundation.org. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is produced by Baruch Zeichner, and at the break, we're listening to the East St. Louis Toodaloo by the one and only Duke Ellington and his Kentucky Club Orchestra. You can find that off his album, The Early Ellington, the complete Brunswick and Vocalion recordings, 1926 to 1931. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. And hey, check us out on social media, where you can find all of this stuff. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IN, for all the latest news in social impact design.